Dealing with Feelings of Love, the 10th and final talk in a series entitled Understanding and Living with the Dynamics of Sex, was presented as a panel discussion led by Jack Crabtree on November 28, 2007 at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
For those of you who weren't here last week, we've shifted the order. We had technical problems last week, and so instead of going ahead with this topic, we did an open question and conversation session. So we're going to come back to the final topic of the quarter, and you should have a handout, or if not, Ron has some here. So we're going to deal with this and have our conversation at least at the beginning center around this, but then since this is the last time of the quarter, we'll open it up and go any way you want to go after that. So I'll go through this quickly, at least in part. I don't know to what extent yet, but at least in part it will be a series of intellectual autobiographies. People are going to tell their story, not their testimony in the traditional sense, because it's not, you know, it's not about how they came to Jesus. It's about how they wrestled with the intellectual questions that are entailed by Christianity and coming to believe that Christianity is actually true and that there is a truth and that Christianity is it. It's dealing with the intellectual challenge of coming to embrace the faith is true. And a number of people are going to tell their stories in that regard. So I think it'll be pretty interesting.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Dealing with romantic feelings, so the practicality of dealing with the fact that we are human beings who do have romantic feelings, or I'm equating them with infatuation. I was talking to someone today who found that problematic to equate the two, but let me just say that's how I'm defining what I mean by romantic feelings, and I'm defining infatuation in a particular way. So to understand and follow what I'm suggesting and what I'm proposing here, it's important that you let me define my terms the way I am. If you want to think of romance differently than I am, that's fine. What I have to say doesn't apply to that, because I'm specifically speaking about this this phenomenon that I'm calling infatuation. And so let me remind you of what I define, how I defined it. It's that thing that happens to us that literally affects my consciousness, affects my perception, and makes me have an emotional response of a particular kind, where I feel euphoric almost when I'm around and with and interacting with the person, and I feel excruciating agony when I'm separated and I'm apart. I mean, that's one of the characteristics of this thing that I'm calling infatuation, being in love. And I suggested that it's a kind of God designed organic drug that God has interjected into human experience that literally alters my way of looking at a relationship with a man or woman, such that the prospect of committing my life to them, to spend the rest of my life committed to them and them alone, becomes interesting to me. You know, becomes plausible as a commitment that I could plausibly make. So I think it has a very positive, plays a positive role in our experience. But what I proposed is, what's important to recognize is that it is just an altered state of consciousness that is sort of artificially induced in us. And I don't know, chemical, more than chemical, I don't know. I don't know what the genesis of it is. But we all, at one time or another, have felt the more or less the effects of it. I mean, at least I think we have. So how do we deal with it? dealing with infatuation. The wrong ways to deal with it or to think about it. First of all, infatuation per se, by itself, is inherently meaningful and substantial. That's the wrong way to think about it. It's not in of itself, by itself, means anything about who I am, what I would do, what I'm able to do, what I am committed to doing. I may feel like I would give my life for the other person, but to feel like you would give your life for the other person is different from actually giving your life for the other person. And it's different from actually being the kind of person who would commit oneself to giving your life to the other person. All infatuation means is that you feel like you want to do that. But there's no substance to that in and of itself unless I take that, the effects of that drug-like experience, and actually turn it into a personal, existential, moral commitment that I'm making. So I can transform it into something substantive, but in and of itself, it's not substantive, and it has no significance or any meaning. So one can act out of this wrong perspective, thinking that the infatuation itself is meaningful and substantial, by first of all acting on it. So I speak and I act and so forth out of this being in love, speaking as if it's reality, acting as if it's reality. So when I do that, I'm acting as if it's something of substance when I'm really not prepared to make it anything of substance. And I think that's a mistake. That's wrong. So, for example, if I take flowers to her, could be something for him, but take flowers to her out of my love for her, or I pursue him out of my love for him, even when I am not getting any encouragement in the relationship from the other person. So there's nothing more annoying than to be loved by someone who's not interested in you. I mean, I can really make a pest out of myself. I'm being driven by this feeling. I believe that it is real. I believe that it is undying. I believe that it is eternal, because it feels like all of those things. And so I certainly feel justified in acting out of it. But other than my feeling, I have no other evidence in my relationships with the other person or the feedback I get from other people around me that there's anything of substance there in the relationship. Well, then I'm acting wrongly. Another thing that we do is that we like the feeling so much, because it's when it's good, it's wonderful. That euphoria is a wonderful feeling. So we like to feed it and keep it alive, by taking every aesthetic experience, listening to music or some kind of visual experience that's interesting, moonlight, sunshine, sunset. And I connect everything with that person. And I try to do everything I can to stoke the fires of this romance, this infatuation, and keep it alive so I can keep feeling like I'm in love. Because to feel like I'm in love feels good. And then the other thing is that we have a tendency to practice wishful thinking as I interpret the actions of the other person, the man or woman that I'm infatuated with. I actually make my love for them be the lenses through which I interpret everything they say, everything they do, everything that they are, and turn it into some kind of justification for why it is that I'm in love with them and why it is that they should love me back. I mean, that it often becomes a justification for putting a kind of subtle pressure on the person to return the love. I love you, and my love is so real and so true and so eternal and so intense that there can't possibly be anyone else that you should love except me. On the other hand, another way, wrong way to think about it is to think of it as inherently sinful. I mean, that's wrong as well. It's not inherently sinful. On the contrary, it can be instrumental in opening us up to consider marriage, which we were built for, we are created for. So there's nothing wrong with it as a phenomenon. two things that would follow from having that wrong attitude. If anything like love enters into my experience, I must cut off my relationship with that person. Marriage must be strictly a spiritual union, at best if it's arranged, and can't have any of this love stuff. That would be wrong. And secondly, not acting even when other considerations would lead me to do so because I am also in love. I think oftentimes people misconstrue what I'm teaching and what I'm suggesting here as being, if you are in love with someone, then just don't have anything to do with them, cut off the relationship, don't act out of kindness, don't act out of friendship, because it's tainted by your being in love. I'm not saying that. You've got to deal with your infatuation, and you need to keep it in perspective and not get waylaid by it. But it doesn't mean you have to stop living life and stop pursuing life and therefore stop pursuing your relationships and your friendships. I'm not suggesting that. Excellent catch, wasn't it? Falling in love happens. It is neither right nor wrong, but it must not be what makes my decisions. It must only be what motivates my making my decisions. So that's probably the most important mistake that people make with respect to love, is that they see the fact that you are in love as validating the decision that that's the person that you should love. And that's not right. Love opens you up to the possibility of how rewarding a marriage commitment can be, but it's not an indicator of who it is that you ought to love, or who you're supposed to love, or who the right person to love for you is. You can fall in love with anybody for a lot of different reasons, and it can happen pretty randomly even at times. I think I've mentioned this before, there's nothing about being married that precludes it happening while you're married. Just walking down the street and all of a sudden just be completely intrigued by a member of the opposite sex. What are you going to do with that? You've already made a commitment. You know there's no substance to that feeling. You know there's no substance to that phenomenon. So the right thing to do is to say, that's ridiculous, and not act on it at all. There's nothing to be acted on there. But when we live in a culture that has the mythology that love itself is the very foundation of any and every wonderful man-woman relationship, if you fall in love with somebody else when you are married, you need to divorce the one you're married to and go marry the one you're in love with. What's the song? Well, no, that's a different theory. If you can't be with the one you love, then love the one you're with, or something like that. That's a different problem. I don't like that one. But if that mythology sets us up, yeah, exactly. But there's all kinds of information we get through music and the media, movies, and all kinds of stuff that is just an incredibly warped perspective. And the one thing that it all has in common is that there's something self-justifying about a relationship that involves love. If you're in love with a person, then there isn't anything wrong that you could possibly do in a relationship to that person because you're in love. And that just couldn't be further from the truth. The feeling doesn't justify anything. So any decision I make has to be made in the context of wisdom, morality, right and wrong, and any other relevant practical considerations. Those are the considerations that go into my deciding whether to marry and who to marry and when to marry and so on, not love. Seems to me that a right way to deal with and think about infatuation is to realize the need and the value of suffering silently in unrequited love. There's a time and place when that's exactly the right thing to do. To suffer is not necessarily evil, and I've mentioned several times here where the times when on particularly this issue I have suffered the most have been some of the best times of my life, spiritually, because I learned I had to come to terms with very, very important issues. Why does God not give me everything I want? And can God be good if he's giving me something that I want this badly? And what does it mean to trust God? Can I trust him with my future? Can I leave my future in his hands, or do I need to make it happen? I mean, those are some of the most important lessons we will ever learn in life. And it's in this context that I learned them, and I think many others have as well. So the suffering and the pain that I went through, as excruciating as it was, as torturous as it was at times, was a wonderful experience for me, because it did wonderfully good things in my life. Okay, the other important thing to do, I've already mentioned, decide my behavior on the basis of other criteria, not on love. And then finally, keep your objectivity. Know eros, what it is, what its effects are, and understand the distorting effect it has on your judgment, your perception, and your desires, and make sure that you gain enough objectivity to compensate for that when you're making judgments about what to do. And then the rest of it is just a repeat, I think, of the stuff that I mentioned with respect to sexual desire. So I'll just leave it at that, because we've already been over that. I think that's it. Questions, comments?
Jack, I have a question for you.
Okay.
In the outline, though not necessarily in what you said that this is a biblical theory of infatuation. And you didn't talk about, like, the Bible specifically. So, and not that you have to, but I'm just wondering, like, what's the, I guess, like, rationale for all of this? Because you have your little paragraph here, but you didn't really talk about it very much. Because it seems like you're wanting to say this is coming out of a deeper understanding of not just, like, it's silly to feel this way, and it's frustrating to feel this way, so I don't want to feel this way. But you're saying that there's something more at stake than just, am I going to make stupid decisions or not? Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little more about that? Does that make
sense?
Well,
my analysis of infatuation is not something that I think you could get from the Bible directly. So in that part of it is not biblical. Yeah, when I call it biblical, what I mean is taking some observations from life experience and the role that infatuation seems to play based on my experience, and then putting that in what is an explicitly biblical framework in terms of priorities, values, what's important, what marriage is, and all that kind of stuff. So that's why I would have the audacity to call it a biblical view. Having said that, I'm not sure that it's not entirely not in the Bible. There is an interesting, Song of Solomon is interesting. I have no idea what to do with that book. But there's a phrase that keeps recurring where it says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, never start a quote you can't finish. There you go. Do not arouse or awaken love until it pleases. Thank you. And one possible way of understanding that is basically that's the counsel that I had later on in my notes. Don't feed love. It'll happen. It's there. It's going to be a part of our experience. But I'm not doing anything good or anything profitable by stoking the fires of love just for the sake of stoking the fires of love, just because I want the experience. So that's the only thing in the Bible that it comes anywhere remotely close to seeming to have the same perspective on love that I'm advocating. But other than that, I can't think of any place in the Bible that actually discusses a theory of infatuation. So that's just my analysis of experience.
So you're saying, but in your understanding of the way that the biblical authors would look at the way you do with your feelings and the way you deal with how that translates into how you're treating your relationship to God, this is the way that you think makes the most sense of that.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
For some reason, maybe I'm the only one, but I feel like we've already covered this issue. So I thought, or maybe you can help me, what is the difference between infatuation and eros?
Yeah, in the way I'm defining them, none.
Okay.
Right. We did. Because we dealt with the theory of infatuation or eros. This was a question of dealing with it. So the only thing that we're making a little bit more explicit, or at least opening up for conversation, if you want to go there, is, so how do I deal with this thing? It's a reality in my life. How do I deal with it?
Okay.
And I do think it's interesting. Jack was saying a minute ago that, I mean, it is mysterious, this thing. It's not really, it's such a powerful force. It's hard to analyze it in a lot of ways, but I think it is, I mean, in some way it is sexually driven, because we don't fall in love with, I mean, we have strong feelings of love for a lot of people in our lives, but we don't fall in love in the same way with our children or with our parents or with a good friend. It is driven by the possibility of uniting in a sexual way. So I think there's something in there, pheromones, I don't know, but something going on. I think also it's important to think about when we're talking about how we work with feelings in general, and I think this would apply to romantic feelings as well, that I think about any feeling that I have as something that I get to know about me. So in that sense, when I have any kind of feeling, if I have a romantic feeling for someone, the force of that feeling and the force of our culture and the force of all everything around it says it's about that person. And it's saying something substantial about what we ought to do together. And that's what I think we're trying to say. Not really. What I would change that into is it tells me something about me. So it's not saying something about that person or what I should do with that person, but it's helping me know that I have a longing or that I have a desire for a partner or a marriage. And I think that's a really valuable thing to know. Jack talks in here about not having that motivate my decisions, but it is a really important part of knowing that that's what I'm working with. And that's true about me. So whether or not this is being given to me, and the fact is it may not be given to me, that's when I have to suffer with that deprivation. And that can be a really good thing to have to do. But again, it comes back to between me and God. You know, it's between me and God. What am I going to do with the fact that I am so crazy in love with this person that doesn't know I exist? It's very difficult. But so I just wanted to throw that in, that any feeling, I think, helps us know something about ourselves if we can go in that direction with it.
On the latter side, I guess, my question would be is, since feelings can be very subjective and not the best judgment, or odometer on the issue of marriage and stuff, what type of feelings or what type of mindset would be correct when you'd want to consider who you would marry? Like, when could you tell that you have the feelings that are the right feelings to have towards that person that says, okay, you truly do respect and love and care for this person? And is there any, not to go Christianese, but any confirmation from God in any way, shape, or form in that area? Not maybe audible, but something.
Well, let me just start by saying, I mean, notice that through most of the history of mankind, marriages were arranged. So the decision was, how much money does the family have and what kind of status? I mean, all kinds of bizarre criteria were being used by parents, not by the person actually making the decision to get married. There are a lot of things that American culture does wrong, but I think one thing that has developed in Western culture is the idea that marriage should be entered into freely by the person who's going to be married. I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing. I think that makes a lot of sense. Because it is a moral commitment, therefore it only stands to reason that the way that I am respected the most in that institution is if I get to freely make that moral commitment that I'm making. Because there's no moral obligation to marry anybody. But when I enter into the relationship, I'm making a moral obligation to that person. Well, I should have a choice in that matter. I should decide whether I want to do that. So the ideal, it seems to me, is to marry someone that I have grown to respect, trust, know in such a way that I can make an informed decision about where I can say to myself, I mean, the question that I think everybody should ask is, in my case as a man, am I willing to learn to be the kind of man, the kind of husband to that woman that God wants me to be? And it's directed at a specific woman. Am I willing to be the husband that God wants me to be for her and spend the rest of my life learning how to do that? Then that's the right person for me. It's not about her. It's about my willingness to make that commitment. The person becomes the right person if I am willing to make that commitment. So I wouldn't call them feelings, but the realities that are there are respect, a certain amount of affection, trust toward the other person. That's the thing that you're looking for. And I don't think it's because those are some kind of signs or barometers. It's just a matter of that's what wisdom would dictate, that the wise thing to do is to marry the person that I want to marry and that I want to marry for the right reasons, namely that she has the quality of character that would allow her to enter into the same commitment to me that I'm going to enter into with her. Beyond that, I don't think much else matters. You know, compatibility. Just because you're compatible today doesn't mean you're going to be compatible 10 years from now in terms of your interests and your desires and so on, because people change. And the person you marry is a moving target. What stays the same is the commitment to that person.
And you are the other part of the moving target.
Yeah, exactly.
So you guys have been talking a lot about that it's important to respect the person that you are going to marry. And I was wondering if you could discuss that a little more, because it seems like there are different types or different levels of respect that you might give to people. Like, it seems like everyone deserves a certain amount of respect for the fact that they're a created being of God. So there's like something inherent in just being human that deserves respect. But it seems like you guys are talking about something more and something different, the respect that you would want to have for your wife or for your husband. So I'd like to hear more about that.
No, I have nothing to say.
Oh, okay. Well, no, that's not true. You do. I've heard you say things about that before. I think that's an important distinction to make. Because sometimes in your marriage, your spouse may do something that could make you, that could genuinely be something that you would anger you or you'd be disappointed with or something like that, that you would have a hard time saying, I really respect that decision or what you did or something there. And there is this other kind of respect, which is to acknowledge that I am going to respect you as a person made in the image of God who is as worthy of consideration as I am. I'm going to forgive you because I would want to be forgiven myself, and that kind of respect that I would want to give to any other human being. I would have an obligation to be forgiving to someone that I was not married to as well, for instance, and respect someone who I think was making wrong choices and someone that I would not actually choose to spend a lot of time with because they're not very nice and they're not particularly trustworthy and so forth. I still need to respect them as a human being and be concerned for their welfare and so forth. So yeah, there is, I think, what I would mean, and I think you do, when we're talking about that sort of respect that is aligned with trust, that says fundamentally, I know this person well enough to know, I'm willing to say, let's join our lives together, and I know you're a sinner, and I know that I will be disappointed in things, but fundamentally, when you say, you're on my side, I believe you. When you say you want to try to join your life together with mine, I believe that commitment, that is what you mean and intend to do. There are things about you, the way you treat other people and that sort of thing, that I'm glad to be aligned with you. I'm not sorry that we're a team together, because I like what we are together because of what you bring to things. And that's the kind of stuff I think that, and you're right to make the distinction, but I think you'd be looking for that stuff, you know, to say, you know, I'm going to be embarrassed for anybody to know that I'm married to this person for the rest of my life, probably ought to give you some pause as to whether that's the person you want to marry, no matter how much in love with you you might be. You know, I'm desperately in love, but let's just keep it secret that we're together, you know, because if that makes any sense. I mean, there's that, I'm seeing something in the other person that is not true of everyone I know.
So it's like a respect for their way of doing things?
For that character, I think, is kind of what I'm, the kind of thing I'm thinking about. Is that?
Yeah, their character and they're just their own created individuality that you like this individual, this unique individual that they are, and want to get to know them better. I mean, what Ron just described there is actually not that unusual. At least when I don't know what things are like out there these days, but when I was younger, it wouldn't be unusual to find a guy who was in love with a girlfriend that he didn't respect. That was not unusual. So they don't automatically go together. Respect comes from, see, the girlfriend that you're in love with is also just, you want her to simply be a reflection of yourself. She becomes a thing. You know, you use her, you control her, the classic example of that was Elvis Presley marrying whoever he married.
Priscilla.
And I just literally made her the woman that he wanted her to be. I mean, that's just sort of the paradigm of how it shouldn't be. To respect a woman is to let her be the person that God created her to be and sit back and watch her blossom into that person and enjoy it and admire it and get to know it and learn who she is, not to make her a creation of mine. And that's the opposite of respect. So she just becomes a thing that I can manipulate and control.
And part of the experience of being in love, part of these romantic feelings, what happens is that in psych terms, there's a dropping of ego boundaries. So it's like we're one person. You know, when we're in love, it's like we don't have any differences. We think the same. We are the same person. And it's a powerful experience. And what Jack is saying, I think, is so critical, because you're not the same. You're still two separate people that have separate trajectories and separate directions in life, becoming separate, created individuals before God, responsible to God. And for a marriage to nurture that while joining those two people into one life is an amazing project. I mean, but to have that individual person be supported and enjoyed, and that is something that has to, that's a deeper layer of this committed love than this romantic feeling of love will ever bring, even though it has with it this separateness that is really appropriate. Does that make sense? Is that helpful? And so I might add to thinking about it in the converse way also, am I respected by this person? So not only are they somebody that I respect, but do I feel that they respect me? And for example, if it's, you know, the case where I have this person saying that they love me madly, but they don't want me to meet their parents, or they love me madly, but they really don't want to say we're together, or they really don't want to not flirt with other women because it really makes them feel good about themselves to do that. You know, there's all kinds of different manifestations of, I'm not sure I'm really being respected here as the individual person, that unique person that I am, that they want to know me, not a reflection of themselves. And when you're in love, it's really hard to know that because of that dropping of ego boundaries and the fact that we just feel like we're one person. It's an amazing rush to feel that. So it's hard to stay sane in that and know in what way am I reflecting what I want you to be, and in what way are you reflecting what you want me to be, and what do we really know about each other, and on what basis then would we make that decision about joining our lives?
I have a question kind of on a different line. Back home, it's really easy to tell if a guy is interested in you or if a girl's interested in you because there is such wide segregation. And if you're interested in somebody, you go make contact. But in, I guess, a lot of...
Step out on the porch and holler.
In a lot of places, that's not, I mean, there isn't that segregation that there is back home. It's a lot harder to tell. So I guess my question is, when you are infatuated with somebody and you think maybe this would be a good match or something, how would you ever know if they're interested in you? I mean, it's like suffer in silence. Well, yeah, you can do that, but it looks an awful lot like... not acting. So
yeah, the suffering in silence part comes after the having tried and got the message. From my perspective, you reach out, and there are just a lot of variety of different ways that you can do that, but you know, would you like to go with me and see a movie, have coffee? would you like to do something with me? And when you start getting some no's sprinkled in with the yes, no, I can't do that, they're subtly sending you a message that, well, no, I'm not that interested. And that's where it becomes important, what lenses you're looking at it through. If you're looking at it through the eyes of, you really owe it to me to love me because I love you so much, you don't even, that doesn't even become any kind of evidence to you. It doesn't even say anything to you. So it's important that you try to get enough objectivity that you understand what that might mean. But you can still keep trying, too. I mean, as long as you're not really annoying about it, you can always keep testing the waters and see is there any change of attitude here?
that on? Oh. That doesn't work.
What doesn't work?
What you just said.
Well, try something else then.
Well, okay. So, I mean, in a situation like this at the house where people, the person you maybe are infatuated with is quite possibly someone you spend a lot of time with.
Yeah.
Like, or even like one of your best friends. If you keep saying, let's go for coffee, of course they're going to want to go for coffee because they're like your best friend. So like, what? Then.
Yeah. No, you have to figure out your context. You have to figure out your context to know what would mean what. I mean, what would their accepting that invitation mean? I mean, that's not a good way of testing it in this kind of context then. So what is? And I don't have the answer to that. But. There you go. There you go.
Or like, do you want to spend Christmas with my family? Like
that would do it. That would do it.
And then the other
or
one.
Or send for NC to test the waters. Yeah. No, that gets messy. I'm just kidding.
Or you said you could keep testing the waters, but quite possibly the person is just like, no, I don't like you. I will never like you. Please stop liking me because it's ruining our friendship. In which case, you just kind of have to buck up and be like, okay, the most loving thing for me to do right now is stop this because I'm being really unkind to this other person by loving them. You know what I mean?
By expressing pressure about the fact that I'm in love with them.
Or even, I mean, even not even expressing pressure, but even like maintaining hope when they've said, there's no hope, please get over me.
Well, because I think that ends up feeling like pressure.
Yeah, it's true.
And that isn't loving. It's not listening. Yeah.
But in defense of all of us who suffer with unrequited love or have in our past, it's you can't just get over it. I don't think it doesn't work that way. I mean, you can't just command it to go away. So it has to be a two-way kind of thing. You have to also be willing to let them suffer. Don't feel pressure from their suffering. It's not an evil. It's not your fault. It's not a bad thing. They're not asking you to. I mean, hopefully, they shouldn't be asking you to take their suffering away, but they can't just stop. It'll go away in time, but they can't just stop on a dime.
But I mean, there's a difference between like stop loving me and stop hoping, because if they're yes, their love is unrequited, but they still have this nagging like, oh, if I just wait long enough, he'll feel the same way about me, and if I just stay faithful to him, he'll. You know, and like not even saying anything, but just sitting there and being like, I'm just going to bide my time until he feels the same way about me. And
well, I think one of the things to keep in mind in that scenario is that listening is really important. And also acting on what's true now is really important. Because truth is important. And if what's true is that now it's not there, then I need to act on that. And so if I'm the one with the broken heart and the wishing, it's very difficult. I mean, like Jack says, it's not like it's just going to go away. You're not going to just get over it. But I think to act on the reality that this is not what's going to happen, even if it does happen 2 years from now, I need to be behaving right now as if it's not going to happen. Does that make sense? I mean, I don't know exactly what that would look like in every case, but it might look like I can't hang out with that person as much because I can't handle it. And so I got to tone it down. And I know that's difficult to do in this community because everybody's right here. But as much as possible, I think that's important to, you know, work with other friendships, to increase the support base in some way or, you know, be creative. What are you giggling about? Do you want to say something?
No?
It's not like you don't have any experience with it.
In order to do... I just want to highlight what Nancy just said. In order to do that, you know, one of the reasons that we don't want to act right now like it's not happening is because we don't really trust God to make happen what's supposed to happen, that if it's going to happen, I need to make it happen. And if I don't make it happen now, there's the most wonderful thing in my life is going to disappear, and it's all my fault because I let it go away. I didn't make it happen. And I think that's the pressure that we feel to not follow Nancy's advice and just, you know, read the objective reality of what's going on right now and just act accordingly. If God wants to change it in the future, he's going to change it in the future. And if God intends for me to marry that woman or that man, no one in hell is going to be able to keep it from happening. And I need to be able to approach it with the confidence that if it's meant to be, it's going to happen. And then I can feel free to not have to control, manipulate, manufacture, contrive the relationship right now, which is what really trips us up.
Okay, and I just want to clarify, I meant she has experience living in the house and, like, being up close.
I'm actually a stalker. I'm just kidding. maybe this is wrong, but I feel like with both of the last two questions, kind of the thread that's going on here is that this tends to be kind of a game, and that's a really frustrating game. And my personality is like, well, whatever, like, just talk about it and fight or something, but just stop playing games. But, I mean, I know that's not really that realistic, and so I'll try to be sensitive in my response to that. But, like, I do think that it's really easy to just be like, well, you know, if I play my cards right, you know, and there's a certain element of you are playing cards when you're interacting with people in a certain sense. Like, you have to be sensitive to them. You have to be, like, you're only going to be heard in ways that you make yourself able to be heard in a certain sense, if that, does that make sense? No? Okay. Well, whatever. But I'll try again later. Like, you are communicating yourself to people, and you are choosing the way in which you're communicating. And so if you're intentionally communicating yourself one way, they're not going to perceive you as, like, the complete opposite. This is getting really abstract. Anyway, so point being that even though there are game-ish elements to interacting with people, I think that one of the most important things is to not get, like, stuck in the game-ish parts of it and just be really willing to, like, if somebody's, like, obviously stuck on you and is obviously asking you out for coffee or whatever, be like, hey, I'm not interested and I'm really sorry, but, like, I'm really willing to be your friend, but if that's, like, not okay with you, like, that's okay. We don't have to, like, keep doing this. That's fine. And, like, that's really awkward, but I've done it, and I feel so relieved afterwards, because then they're just like, oh. And either they keep doing it, and they know they're being pathetic, or they stop. And maybe that's a mean thing to say, but I think that it's really important to not just be like, oh, well, the guy's being pathetic, he's being stupid. Like, make sure you're communicating what you're trying to communicate. And if you have a question for somebody, like, unless there's, like, a pretty set, like, social code that, like, you know, when I step off the porch, that means I'm going to ask you to marry me. Like, that means it's going to be messy, and there are very few communities that have signals like that. And in a way, that's very unfortunate. But in a way, like, that's just something you're going to have to deal with, especially if you move from place to place, and you're just going to have to figure it out. And I always think being upfront is a very good policy, no matter which side you're on. So that's what I would like to say.
I would just say that someone being pathetic is to be really cared about. So I think you would probably say that too. But if someone is being pathetic, I think it's important that we care about the fact that they're really suffering.
Yeah.
So.
Sure, whatever. Yeah, I agree, Scarlett. The only problem is that there's a lot of, we can get so confused that if we're just going to talk about it, you know, there's been a lot of situations in my life where if somebody said, let's just sit down and talk about it, I wouldn't know what to say because I don't even know myself. I don't know my own thoughts. I don't know my own feelings. I'm going to need time to process things before I'm going to be able to sort things out. What you were describing was pretty clear. So there, in a situation like that, that makes a lot of sense. But as a general rule, we just need to sit down and talk about the relationship. Not every context will that work, I think.
Yeah, I guess I'm not meaning like a hashing out kind of conversation. I mean a making my intentions and my placement very clear.
Yeah,
and so if you're not ready to move forward with a relationship, don't bring it up.
Right.
If somebody else has brought it up and you're not willing to move forward with it, just say, I'm just not interested. And I don't know if this is cruel. I feel like this is kind of cruel. But what I've been told and what seems to be true is especially if a guy is like, hey, I'm interested. And you're like, well, I'm not interested in you right now. Like, you probably, maybe I'm wrong. You can tell me. But what I have experienced is that if you say, well, right now's not a good time for me. Or if you try to soften it, there's always this like, oh, well, if I overcome that hurdle, then she'll be interested. You know, and I think it's like,
no,
I don't think
true.
It's cruel to just be like, I'm not interested. Like, that's just, and you don't even have to give her a reason. You can just say, I'm not interested. And then they don't have anything to, like, whine about.
No, that's an excellent point, because as we've talked about a little bit before, guys have it, and this carries on into marriage, guys have a tendency to think that you mean what you say, not what you really meant. And so by softening it, they're not hearing that as a message, no, but I'm saying no softly. They're hearing it, oh, okay, so if I just change things, yeah, and that's exactly right.
I don't want to come across as saying, like, if you're trying to be nice, then you're lying. Because I know, like, from my experience of times when I have been nice in that situation, and also times, there aren't very many of them, and also times when, like, you know, friends have had these kinds of experiences, whatever. It's not that they're lying. It's not that they're saying, I'm not interested, but I'm trying to communicate that I am interested. What they're saying is, I'm not interested, but I care about you as a person, and I hope that you know it's not because you're a jerk or I hate you or that you're the scum of the earth. Like, I'm just not interested. And so I think it's really easy to hear that as, oh, there's hope, when what she's really saying is, I don't hate you, you're not a terrible guy. But, and the guy's just like, I'm not a terrible guy? Really? You know, and so I don't want to come across as saying that, like, being mean is the alternative, or that, like, if you're being nice, you're lying. Like, I don't think those are mutually exclusive. Whatever. Yeah.
No one wants to ask something. Did you take that over there?
Can I say something first?
Yeah.
Because I got the microphone in order to say something.
I thought you had it a minute ago. That's right. She had it since then.
That's being direct.
Good job.
Yeah. I work really well with direct, and like the softening is not a good idea, like you're saying. The very clear cut, bold, I don't like you. Nope, sorry, not going to happen. Very good, very cool.
You support that approach.
And with what you said before, after you guys were dialoguing, about if it's going to happen, then it's going to happen, don't make it happen. That's true. But if you put down your cards and say, if God wants me to win, then I'll win, well, you ain't going to win because you don't have your cards in your hand. You're not even playing. So it's not like, oh, if God wants me to get married, I'll get married. And in the meantime, I'm going to hang out in my room and read philosophy and forget that there's anything else.
Well, you will be doing some of that while you're in school here.
Okay, so before, I want Noah to ask his question, but that's a good point that you make, and I don't want to derail this off onto a philosophical discussion of the sovereignty of God, but I feel like I'm a notch or two, I wouldn't quite put it as strongly as you guys have been doing about if God wants you to get married, in terms of the sovereignty of God, I agree with this. Okay. I mean, if God wants anything to happen, I mean, I could throw myself off a cliff and say, if God wants me to float, I will. But it's still not a good idea to throw yourself off a cliff, because he probably doesn't. So, right? There is an element of...
I think that
the trust that I want to have is that God is, I mean, like Romans talks about, God is working all things in my life together for my good. I can count on God in my stumbling around. You know, I may think that this is the person I need to marry and have it totally wrong and all of that, that I'm confident that God knows what he's doing and that he is leading my life in a way that I can trust him. And maybe occasionally the way you put it, it makes it sound like almost like I can be confident. I don't have to, like, I shouldn't bother to, like, look. If I'm interested in being married, I shouldn't bother to ask myself the question to try to meet, you know, Christian women that I would be interested in, because if I'm going to get married, God will bring her along or something. I don't know that. You don't really mean that, do you? I mean, it's not necessarily that acting would be inappropriate. So,
well, I have something to add to that. I totally agree, and I say it that strongly also because I think it's true that if we can, my emphasis when I say that is we feel so desperate when we're in love that it just seems like I have got to make this happen now. And that's what I think we're trying to address, is that desperateness is something that I really have to come to God with and say, you're in charge of this. I'm not. I'm going to have to let this go. And that's what I'm getting at when I say act on what's true now. Because if I act on what's true now, then what does that look like? If this person is not interested in me and I'm heartbroken by that, then maybe for a season I stay in my room and read philosophy. But then I'm going to have to decide, how do I know that that's not what's happening, and how do I act on that? Start looking around a little more. If marriage is on the plate for you right now, I mean, this is another thing, is I don't think there's any sense necessarily in making something happen if you're not personally ready at a particular place in your life where, you know, marriage is something I want to consider by now. So you don't have to be in a hurry that way either. But I think it is true that, you know, when marriage is something that you're interested in pursuing, I mean, and we could get into another topic on this about how I think men and women have to work with that really differently, because with the desire to be married, men have, I think, a lot more, it's going to be unprocessed, I probably shouldn't go there. It's easier for men to choose women and see if they're interested than it is for women to do the same. In many cases. Not always, but in many cases that's true. And so women have a different challenge to be working with, and so I'm not really addressing that. But I do think that, action is appropriate. And so then what do you do when you want to start meeting people? And around here, meeting people is not the trouble. But it's kind of working with the drama and the realities and what's true about each other and our friendships. And that's a challenge. But yeah, action is definitely appropriate. But it might be action that lines up with what's true now. And that means letting it go.
Yeah, ditto. Just, it takes two to be married. And I can't control, I can try, but I can't control their decision. That's where the trust of God comes in. Yeah, I'm going to be proactive out of my own desires and my own longings. And so, I mean, it only is rational to do so. It doesn't make any sense not to. But they're going to have to say yes when I ask. And I don't have any control over that. So if they're saying no right now, then what Nancy is saying is then take the no. But don't, out of desperation, try to twist their arm into saying yes now, because otherwise it'll be lost forever. No, God can change the heart. And if it's meant to be, he'll change their heart.
And he can bring a different person along also, if he intends for you to be married. And if he intends for you to not be married, there's not much you can do about that either. You can do everything you want to make it happen. And if God says no, he says no.
Okay, so is communication between guys and girls actually possible? I mean, I just, like, I see, like, people's motivations...
Did you understand what he's asking?
Like, people's motivations are, like, so complex, and I don't think I even realized that until, like, maybe, like, this year, or maybe last year. Like, I look around at things people are doing, and, like, I'm at the point now where it's like, yeah, I don't know why they're doing that. Like I can think of a gazillion different reasons why they could be acting that particular way, and, like Scarlett, your example, just, like, being blunt, and, like, I'm not interested in you, okay, that's fine, but, like, do you mean that? Like,
I don't think you have a question about that.
No, but like it's true. I mean, my perspective would be like, I would just probably trust you if you said that. But then, like, so there's the question of like, why haven't they just? They obviously know that I like them. So why haven't they, like? And they're obviously not interested. But maybe they are interested. Maybe they're just pretending that way because. They, you know, various reasons. Like, it's just, like, so ridiculously complex. And then you throw in the whole thing of, like, I don't even think like them. And so, like, I could maybe guess what, like, another guy's motivations are as, like, a third, like, outsider looking on. But then I try to figure out the girls, and, yeah.
Do you know what motivates you?
Yeah, it's, like, sometimes, like, you have to be pretty introspective. But I at least have a clearer picture of what motivates me than what motivates the other person.
That gets less clear the older you get.
Okay, thank you.
Glad you have that clarity.
I think that the point of what Nancy's saying is that it's not necessarily because men and women can't communicate with each other as much as we don't always know ourselves, even when you're like 40, 50, 60, 70, whatever. Like, you might not actually know why. You probably think you know why you're doing a lot of things, and you might know why you're doing some things. But there are a lot of things that I've explained to myself, and they made so much sense at the time. And then afterwards, I was like, oh, I was doing that for completely the reason I told myself I was not doing that. I mean, everybody does that, but that's not what I wanted to say. The main point...
It's we're so complicated. And we're complicated inside of ourselves also. So, yeah.
The thing that I wanted to say was the whole guessing game thing again. Is just that you can totally go bonkers trying to figure out why you feel a certain way, why you're acting a certain way, why somebody else is acting a certain way, why they seem like they're feeling a certain way. And it's just such a waste of time. And you're not going to be able to keep from doing that on a certain level. It's completely impossible if you're infatuated with somebody, if you really like them, even if there are really good reasons for you to like them, but it might just not be a good idea, you know, or it might not be possible. Or maybe it is a good idea, maybe you should get married to them, but you have no idea what they're thinking, you know? But I don't think your goal should necessarily be, how do I interpret this person's actions, as much as, how do I communicate myself as clearly as I can? How do I take that person at their word? And if they're wrong and there's some sort of miscommunication, you hash it out later. Like, I guess what I'm saying is, it's frustrating to me when people second guess what I'm trying to say, when I'm just trying to do the best job I can of communicating. And then they go around and say, like, oh, well, she said this, but she was holding her hand this way when she said it, so she means the opposite. You know? Like, that's just really counterproductive. And if someone says no, specifically, like, it's really easy to be like, well, they said no, but they'll mean yes later. But if you just take them as saying no, if that's not what they meant, they'll figure it out. Like, if you said, hey, I really like you, I want to marry you, and she's like, well, I'm just not interested. And you're like, okay, all right, well, that sucks, and I really am, that was not the answer I was hoping for, but all right. And you walk away, and she actually does want to marry you, she'll tell you. I mean, like, she's not going to just be like, oh, I told him no, so I've got to stick with that.
No, I agree with you.
She does.
Like, but I do think that, like, if I'm going to be wise in the way I convey myself, I have to at least make an attempt at figuring out what their motives are, because that's to some extent going to direct how I act, And it's, I think where I've begun to be like shocked in talking with girls about like various relationships and stuff, like taking someone at their word is different for guys than it is for girls. Like, you can look at a situation and come away, and I'd say, so what is their word that I'm taking would be, like, totally different. And so I guess that's my question is, like, I mean, maybe in a case where it's really, really direct, like, no, like, I hate you. Like, we could take that at their word, but that's a pretty stark line. And any kind of gray zone, like, can we actually, like, figure out what they're trying to communicate?
Well, wouldn't you say that in any relationship, with any interaction with any other human being, and I'm sure you've experienced this in your discussions too, like, understanding and communicating to other people is a skill that is going to take a really long time. And there are a lot of girls that I don't understand at all. Like, and so I just don't really find the whole, like, I don't understand guys thing very compelling, because there are a lot of girls I just don't get at all. And there are a lot of guys I don't get either, but like, understanding people and communicating between completely different people with completely different perspectives is just going to be really challenging. And I don't know, maybe there are some things from your experience that can be more applicable to men than to women, or vice versa, but I don't know if there's a very easy answer for that.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by taking someone at their word differently between men and women. Or is that what you were saying?
Yeah, I guess just what I'm saying is, in any case when it's just not a like really stark statement, then if I'm thinking like take someone at their word means just like accept what they're saying to me, but I may have a completely different understanding of what they're saying to me than someone else might have.
Right. So that might take some more communicating in order to understand. So in other words, in a scenario, in an example where someone says something to me and there's somebody else hearing them and I take it one way and they take it a whole different way, what would you do in a discussion?
Well, in a discussion I would try to clarify.
And you might try to see what you think the author says. Mm-hmm. In this scenario, you have the author right there. So ask, is it this or is it that? What did you mean? We took it really differently. I mean, I think that's a really appropriate course.
And so, in my experience, mm-hmm. I find myself constantly, after I have a conversation, thinking of everything I didn't understand and wanting to go find that person mm-hmm. and be, so what did you mean by this? And what did you mean by this? And what did you mean by this? And then I come mm-hmm. away from that conversation and like, oh, shoot, I didn't understand any of that either. Yeah. And I think that can be irritating for a person if every half hour you're coming up to them like with a new list of things you didn't understand.
Yeah. Definitely. Could be. So at that point, you have to kind of work with your discomfort of not understanding and struggle with that.
I figured.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your initial question was it possible? In the end, I think it is. I agree with Scarletta. It's a skill we need to learn. I would add or emphasize maybe more strongly that I think sexuality is a contributing factor in what makes communication different. And it's very difficult to analyze. I think we could be way oversimplify that. But it is my experience that there really is a way of being a woman in the world and a way of being a man in the world. And the way of being a woman affects the way she uses language, and the way of being a man affects the way we use language, and they don't always jive very well. So, yeah, I think you have put your finger on something, that it really does complicate even further what is already a complicated process, and that is understanding how we use our words and our language. But it's a skill you learn. And the more experience you get, the more you are able to realize, like when you get married, my wife is a woman, so I need to take that into account in how she's communicating with me and how she's using language. And I totally am empathetic with you. I mean, I just remember how incredibly unsatisfying it was to go, and when I was approaching marriage to Jody to go and have a conversation with her and walking away with absolutely none of my questions answered. I didn't have a clue what just happened. And I don't know how we made it, but I'm here.
It's a cross-cultural experience, times 10.
Jack, this isn't like a huge disagreement necessarily, but I think that the way that your gender affects the way that you communicate thing, I think it's really easy to be like, well, men do this and women do this. And I think there is some sort of like difference. I would see it as like fuzzier than maybe you do. I don't know. But I don't know if that's just because I'm younger. I don't know, because I feel like in at least my growing up, there's been a much looser definition of like, this is what it means to be a woman. This is what it means to be a man. This is how you communicate yourself within that. And I feel like especially with my parents, there's a much more defined expectation of, as a woman, I communicate myself this way. As a man, these are the expectations people have of me, etc. And so, I mean, I suppose it depends on the culture that you grew up on into. And I'm not saying it's like purely cultural, but I am saying that like that's going to change, like what the content of that distinction is, like between like what culture, what time, what generation, whatever.
No, absolutely. And I meant to say that it was fuzzy by saying one could really oversimplify that and come up with little catchy phrases about women always do this and men always do that, which will never actually hold up. But just because we can't codify and mm-hmm. analyze the difference doesn't mean there at root isn't something happening there. That mm-hmm. And that's what I'm saying. Right.
I just get really... It seems really easy for guys to say like, oh, well, she's just doing that because she says this, and because she's a woman, that actually means this, when that has absolutely nothing to do with what I was saying. You know, and I guess that's the only thing that I'm trying to be like, careful with that. I mean, I think recognizing that is important.
That's really the only power we have, is to diss women by themselves.
That's great.
Before I started giggling, I was just going to say that I think it is enculturated in a lot of ways, how we respond as men and women. And I think it's very fundamental also, because we really are in the world differently. And so that's, I think, kind of part of it.
I don't mean this as, I'm not saying that I know how things will work out, or I mean, things can work out all kinds of different ways. But it seems to me that one of the things, I mean, as I'm dealing with the reality of getting to know this person and working out whether, you know, is she going to be interested in getting together with me? Are we headed toward marriage and all of that stuff? That one of the things that contributes in that process is you're not ready to get married to somebody if you don't feel like you understand what she's saying to you. So one of the things that's going to make a difference is in that process, that as you're communicating, as you start to feel like you have a clearer idea of what it is she's talking about, that's one of the indicators that, I mean, and assuming that the clarity is not in the direction of get lost, but the, so it's not, I know it's frustrating, but in a way, I think it's helpful to think about it as just part of the process. I mean, this is part of my getting to know this person, is I'm not getting this in this process, but if this were to move ultimately and toward us getting together, I will get it. I will understand better what she's saying, and she will understand me better, and that'll be part of what'll make this happen. So that's part of the, in a way, the thing to look forward to, or at least respect as part of the process.
And I honestly think that, I think when I started out, I was very resistant to the idea that there were differences between men and women. And as I've understood myself more over the years, I'm much more open to that. And part of that comes out of understanding that the differences are actually quite wonderful. We joke about them and laugh about them, but the complementarity between men and women is really profound. We need each other. Women need men to help them think straighter. Men need women to help them go outside the boxes. And it's a wonderful partnership. So,
what, part of what made the idea of the difference between men and women offensive in our culture, I think, is that it kind of became, I mean, I can remember back in the 50s and 60s, I mean, the way to think about it was there's the rational, normal human way to think about things, and then there's the way women think about things. And that was, I mean, that was the joke. I mean, you know, is that, because all the jokes were being told by men. And so the idea that there's a difference between the way men and women do things, it becomes kind of a put down, a condescending attitude of men towards women. Yeah, there's this difference between the way men and women do things. Part of what I think that's going to be a perennial tension, but in my experience, part of what makes marriage a very important experience in life is that you have an opportunity to really get to know a real person who is a woman, and actually come to recognize, I've said this many times before, but it is true, that's one of the big things that happened to me, is that without intending to, when I got married, I had a condescending attitude toward my wife, that the way I thought about things was obviously the right way to think about things. And so my job was to bring her along and get it to where she could see things the way I did. I'm embarrassed to say that, but it's really true. And I really had to come to terms with that, to recognize, no, this is, I mean, the complementarity thing that Nancy is talking about, that we, the two of us becoming one, we have become more than I could have been by myself. And not just because it's another person. I mean, you might be able to say that if it was another guy, but it's the fact that it's a woman makes that even more the case, because she brings something to this that I couldn't, and most guys couldn't bring, that way of looking at life and that way of thinking about things. And both of those together are human and legitimate ways of looking at life. So in that sense, then, if I think it's easier, I mean, I find it easier to talk about the differences between men and women now, because I have come to respect those differences in a way that I didn't before. And I think there's some truth to that. There are a lot of people who really believe in the equality of the sexes who are actually quite condescending in their attitude toward the other sex. And when I was condescending towards women, I was much more an egalitarian, sort of, you know, we're all the same. But the more that I have come to respect the difference between men and women, the more natural it seems to me to recognize that those differences are there.
Just that complementarity, to add to my answer to your question, one of the things that convinced me more than anything that Jody was the one I should marry is I just really felt at home with her, to talk about a feeling. I felt very comfortable. I felt at home. And I think that complementary nature of male and female is a large part of, I was intuitively recognizing how much she completed what I wasn't. She made whole what I wasn't. So there's an excellent, I heard an excellent lecture once by a feminist child psychologist at Stanford who, back in the 60s, who, she was a pretty committed feminist, but her studies were making it impossible for her to any longer believe that the difference between the sexes was cultural, because she was studying infants as young as, you know, just a number of weeks old on, and I'm not sure how she studied the number of weeks old, but she gave all kinds of examples of what she considered to be innate differences between girls and boys, and they're really, really pretty funny. I mean, they're just, anyone who's been a parent recognizes the stuff that she's talking about. They do experiments where they take some girls and have them play together and some little boys and have them play together, and they'd have a certain limited amount of time that they would let them play. The girls spent the vast majority of their time organizing their play. The boys just start hitting each other, you know, just begging to get them all. They're completely chaotic and unorganized. And the girls were just utterly orderly and rational and organized about it.
I have another question, but it's probably rather lengthy, the answer to it. So I can
We can try. We are just about out of time.
Okay, so speaking of inherent differences, possibly only cultural, so I don't really know how to ask this question in a way that's not laden with cultural Christianity, so I hope that you can filter. So I remember getting the sort of impression from church and from the Bible that guys are supposed to be leaders, or there's this like male headship thing. Like, how do you see that? What do you guys think that means, and how does that fit into this, like, so you want to get married sort of discussion? Like, I mean, like, is the guy supposed to bring that up, or like, is it, I mean, I'm guessing that you guys are going to be like, hum, 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 I'm not going to give you any formula, hum, hum. But but I
quick, just a spider, we need to come up with a formula.
I would like to hear your thoughts on that, and even within marriage, like, what if, you know, a hypothetical sort of situation, like, if the girl, if the woman is inclined to be more of a leader than the man is, and if, just like, how do you guys see that playing out in a good way, in a biblical way, I guess? So, as much of that as you want to take on, which could be none.
Well, you're right. That really is actually a long discussion, maybe even a whole course. suffice it to say for now, I really don't think there's any justification for reading the biblical concept of headship as even leader. I mean, that's not even really the relevant category. It has more to do with, it's a different kind of priority. And it's a priority that doesn't translate well into, you know, I'm the boss, I'm the leader, I'm the king, I'm the priest. All those various things that are used as metaphors or analogy for that, I don't think they're, not only are they not helpful, I think they're actually distort the whole picture of what headship is. So, or I'm the decision maker, you know, I'm the head, so I'm the one who's supposed to make all the decisions. All that's cultural. That's not the biblical picture. But I do think that there is a kind of priority that the Bible presupposes behind in the marriage relationship. And, you know, maybe in another time and place I can, you know, I can try to articulate my perspective on that.
I would love to hear that.
Yeah, and I have just a brief comment to make on that, and I'm not sure, you know, we studied this issue together like 20 years ago or something like that and looked at the New Testament passages and came to some conclusions about some things. I know you've done some thinking about this stuff since. I'm not sure that we even agree anymore about how this stuff works, so I'm not speaking for Jack, but let me, I think it's helpful to think about headship in terms of the concept of responsibility. Okay, that there is a responsibility that a husband has in a marriage. But the analogy that I think is helpful is there are all kinds of ways in all sorts of situations in life where, say there was a manager who has responsibility for the work of a particular group of people, let's say. It's not necessarily the case that the responsibility, I mean, in the end, the management is going to come to that manager and give an account of what your group has done. But a wise manager might step back and recognize this person is much better at doing this stuff than I am, and this person is much better at doing this stuff than I am. And in fact, there's so much experience here at this stuff that rather than me making decisions, we should decide this stuff together, because the decisions will be better if we do it that way. And so it's not that that person is coming along and laying down the law to everyone. In fact, that person is looking for the other people to actually make decisions and determine things. But in the end, that manager is willing to go to the management and say, I will take responsibility for what we did. And that, now that's, it's only an analogy. I mean, I'm not the boss in our family. That's not what I mean. But there's that sense that we can recognize that leadership doesn't have to be bossy, that it can actually, I can have the responsibility for something and yet recognize the superiority of the person that I'm doing this with, and that it would be foolish for me to make the decision when this person is better suited to make the decision than I am. But I will take responsibility for the decision that we make. Something like that. Now, there's a lot that would have to go into that, but I think that's a distinction that I think is important.
Yeah, when we were doing a lot of work on this, biblical feminism was really in vogue, and we were reading all kinds of books arguing, and every one of them took the perspective that if the man is the head over the woman, the only way you could make that sense out of that is if the man is somehow superior to the woman, and that's what Ron is speaking to, is that doesn't make any sense at all. My wife may very well be superior to me intellectually, in experience, academically, educationally, may be vastly superior to me. And yet I could still be the head in the biblical sense. And I won't be a very smart head if I don't recognize how superior she is to me in all those respects.
So in that model, it speaks to understanding strengths and weaknesses and working together as a team in a way that supports one another's gifts and talents and abilities and what they contribute. and yet the one who's going to be called to account on some level for, and I think of it as for the health of the relationship in a lot of ways. I mean, and for the health of the family, that is ultimately going to be where God holds the man responsible in a way different than he holds the woman responsible. Now, I think he's going to hold the woman responsible for something other than that, for what her role has been in doing what she can do to help anytime she can, speaking up, participating, utilizing her strengths, rather than the view that submission is saying yes all the time. But rather, the submission model, I think, comes out of, because the passage also says submit to one another in love. It doesn't just say the one way. But I think that the woman's thing before God is going to be, how did you work with when you gave all that input and he still made a different decision? Did you hold that against him? did you resent it? I think that's more the biblical picture of what the woman's submission is going to look like. So, but it's a real different model than the cultural one.
There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there is.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. It's been fun. Yeah.